So now we move to session three, and we're going to talk about these deep felt needs and how to identify them so that we could work with what God's doing in the person's life. C.S. Lewis observed that there are several deep needs. In one of his books, The Pilgrim's Regress, the first book he wrote after he was a Christian, it's the only allegory he ever wrote too. The Narnian books are not allegories. He called them supposals. But in this one allegory, he has this main character, his name is John, and he saw a vision of an island off in the distance, and the island developed in his heart longing to go to that island. So this is allegorical about all of our lives. We have a sense that something is distant from us, something that we find we crave and long for, and it sets us on a pilgrimage to find how we can connect the longing of the heart to the actual object. And as John is going, he identifies the longings, but he doesn't quite understand them. And in this allegory, he comes to a hermit. And the hermit represents history in the allegory. And John asks the hermit about the longings. And the hermit says, well, there's basically three longings. And he situates each one to a particular period of literary history. I have to say, if there's three longings, there could be 3,003. But these are so dominant that Lewis gives them special place in this story. And the hermit says, the first one is the longing for myth or story. And he situates it in classical times where it's developed in the literature of that age. The second longing is a longing that's manifest in the lady. And the hermit says, for example, the literature of the Middle Ages, and he uses the example of Dante, who had a heart for this young girl named Beatrice, and he's trying to find out what this longing for relationship means. And this is a relational longing. And then lastly, there's a longing that's awakened by nature. And the hermit situates this to romantic times. When I say romantic literature, I'm talking about the literature that was written in Europe, particularly in the late 1700s and the early 1800s. We've got the Lake District poets in England, Wordsworth, Coleridge, and then you've got also in German, you've got Novalis, you've got some of the other poets, English poets, Keats and whatnot. And Wordsworth, when he wrote about nature, particularly in his work, The Prelude, he recognized as he got older, he was getting more jaded. And he was not happy about the kind of callousness that was occurring in his heart. And he longed for the lost innocence of youth. So I'll come back to this, but I want to give a picture, a depiction of each one. So first is the longing for myth. And as the hermit connects these to classical times and we understand it, it opens our eyes to see where a person might be having this particular longing as we've asked the questions and we've gotten deeper with them and we can begin to spell this out and discuss it with them. The longing for myth. Lewis said the mark of a literary person is that they read a book more than once. Some books maybe aren't worth reading even once. But a literary person finds there are some stories they want to keep going back to. It's not unlike the child who hears a bedtime story. And what does the child say after they hear the bedtime story? They say, read it again. Why? Why do they say that? They know the twists and turns of plot. They know the characters. They've heard the story. Why do they say, read it again? And Lewis suggests that maybe it's because they have had awakened in them a longing for the world of that particular story, which he thinks touches them at the place where they long for the only other world they could ever really know, which is a longing for heaven. The story can awaken a heaven-like longing. And you have these stories in the classical myths, I think particularly of Ulysses or the Odyssey by Homer. Ulysses has been off fighting the Greek wars. He's been away from his wife, Penelope, and his home for so long, and he longs to get back home. And his voyage is interrupted by the gods that were on the side of the Trojans. Ulysses had fought for the Greeks. And he longs for home the whole time. The whole story is about a man longing for home. But when he gets at home, he finds it's not the same. These suitors have come and they've made life difficult, and he has to settle accounts with these guys. And what happens in those stories is there's an awakening of a longing for home, a homesickness almost. G.K. Chesterton said that we are homesick in our own homes. And every time we lay our head on a pillow, we lay it down in a foreign land. You have Aeneid by Virgil. And Aeneas was a person on the other side of the Trojan Wars. He was a citizen of Troy. And as Troy is being destroyed by the Greeks, he's warned by others to flee and to build a new home because their home's been destroyed. Augustine was not a fan of these ancient myths, but that particular one he was, because here is Aeneas, who is a citizen of Troy that is no more, longing for the place that will one day be Rome. And Virgil was trying to give the Romans a history of their world. And Augustine said that he thought this was indicative of all of our lives. We're people who are born in this world, but we have a longing for the world that's to come. And if we properly understand it, it sets our hearts questing for how we might get there. The word romantic comes from Virgil's Aeneid, the longing for Rome. But ultimately, it's a longing for the ultimate place. It's a heaven longing. And I think we can see it manifest in many ways. In America, if you go to school, they have reunions. You graduate from the school, you have a 10-year reunion. Then you have a 20-year reunion. Then you have a 30-year reunion. I had a 50-year reunion from my high school. And I had great familiarity with the place where I grew up. I remember playing sports on the vacant lots with my friends. And I go back and now those vacant lots have buildings built on them. I remember the old buildings. And I go back and they've been knocked down and modern monstrosities have been built in their places. You go back and you saw the playground at your school where you played and it seemed like it was massive in size when you were little. And you go back and it seems like such cramped space. How did you ever have fun in a place like that? You finally get to the reunion dinner and they give you a name tag with your name on it and with a picture of you from the yearbook that shows what you look like back then. They have to do that because I go back to these reunions and all my old friends, they're bald, they have gray and white hair, thick glasses, they have a paunch in their stomach, you know, and life has been hard on them. I'm fine, but life's been hard on them. And we realize we go back, but when we go back, it's not the same. We're longing for something that has permanence, something that will be the same, something that transcends mutability and change. And it's a heaven longing. And you can find it oftentimes. Right? C.S. Lewis said you could hear a person say, "Wow, look at John, all grown up now. How time flies." He says, why are we surprised by time if we're mere temporal creatures? Doesn't the surprise by time, how time flies, wow, doesn't that suggest to us that maybe we're not mere temporal creatures, that we're eternal and that we're made for something that is permanent and forever, will last forever? Then you've got the longing for the lady. And again, he gets this from Dante. If you've read Dante, he wrote, the first book he wrote was A Vita Nuova, and it's about when he met a girl on the streets of Florence, Beatrice Portinari. And he didn't understand what this was. It was first love kindled in his heart. And he's holding a candle for Beatrice, and he's longing for her, but he ends up marrying somebody else, and he ends up having his children by somebody else. Beatrice marries somebody else. She dies fairly young. But Dante's constantly trying to figure out, what was Beatrice all about? What was this relational longing all about? Years later, he writes A Divine Comedy. In The Divine Comedy, he finds himself in limbo, and there's this guy named Virgil, who, remember, wrote the Aeneid, the story about longing for a place. And Virgil begins to lead Dante because Beatrice had sent word to Virgil to collect Dante and guide him through the Inferno, the Purgatorio, and on into the Paradiso. And in that story, Virgil is guiding him. There are all kinds of other adventures. It's a great book. It's one of the classic texts of Western literature. And so as he's guiding him, he's still trying to figure out what Beatrice is all about. And there comes the place when he gets through the Purgatorio, halfway through the Purgatorio, Beatrice comes out of heaven and collects him and leads him towards the Paradiso. And eventually she leaves him. And Dante says, she turned to look, but not at me. She turned to the eternal fountain. And all of a sudden the light goes on for Dante. It wasn't Beatrice. But it was a relationship with Beatrice that was awakening to the primal relationship, his relationship with God. It's interesting that after C.S. Lewis's wife died, he wrote a book working through his grief called A Grief Observed. The last lines of that book are in Italian, where Lewis writes, she turned to look, but not at me. She turned to the eternal fountain. And Lewis is understanding this. All human loves, however powerful they might be, cannot ultimately fulfill us. And that all human love, properly understood, is awakening in us a desire for our ultimate first love. Remember in the book of Revelation where Jesus writes to the church at Ephesus and he says, I have this against you. You've left your first love. If you leave your first love, you're never going to make sense out of any kind of secondary or tertiary love. We need to keep our hearts burning for Christ foremost of all. And if I meet a person who thinks that there's going to be a relationship that's going to fulfill them, you don't have to tell them, no, that's not true. You just have to ask them, is it in the relationship that you're connected with right now? And you may marry this person. You may have good relations with them. You may have the best of human relations with them, but it can't ultimately fulfill. I'll give you another example. Have you ever felt lonely in your life? I've never had a person that I've asked that question of who said to me, no, I've never felt lonely. Everybody knows what it feels like. I can even say, have you ever felt lonely living under the same roof with people you love and you know they love you? Have you ever felt lonely in a crowd? The fact that we're lonely tells us we're sociological beings. We're made for relationship. The fact that we can communicate says that we're made for community. But if you've ever felt lonely in your life, in a crowd, or lonely with people you know love you, doesn't that fact not strongly suggest that you might have been made for a relationship no mere human relationship can ultimately satisfy? The longing for relationship is a place where the deep longings open up the door for us to introduce the longing and the answer to that longing, the object of that longing, the God who is a God of reconciliation, the God who heals estrangements, the God who forgives sins, the God who restores ultimate relationship with Him so that we can enjoy best the relationships that are secondary and tertiary. And I think this is a really important one. And then you have also the third longing that Lewis writes about in The Pilgrim's Regress is the longing for nature, or the longing to have that which is spoiled be restored to its natural state. We long to have the brokenness in us fixed. I don't know about you, but I'm weary of my brokenness. I can't wait for heaven. I can't wait to have everything fixed. And God wants to do that for us. And when we are aware of our shortcomings, then that is a place where God opens our eyes to see how precious is the gospel. Frederick Buechner, he used to say, before the gospel could be good news, it's got to be bad news. C.S. Lewis said, you have to awaken in a person their sense of sin. I think anybody who's lived a moment of honest life already in some senses has an awareness of this, but probably suppresses it. Paul said we suppress the truth in our unrighteousness. and we're not necessarily looking at these things accurately. I can remember years ago, I was asked to speak in an evensong service at one of the Oxford University colleges. The chaplain was a guy named Michael Chantry, and he asked me to have high table with the faculty. High table is a spectacular event at Oxford. These halls are huge, and they have long tables that run the length of the hall, and that's where the students sit. At one end, perpendicular to the long table, three steps up, is the faculty table. If the students are eating roast beef, the faculty are eating prime rib. If the students are eating steak, the faculty are eating filet mignon. Everybody comes dressed in their academic gowns. Huge paintings of benefactors line the walls of the halls, and these guys are looking down at you, I think to make sure you're using the right knife, fork, and spoon, because they've got so many there. I've never seen so many in my life. And then they begin the meal with a Latin prayer. The wine pours freely, and you can cut the pretense with a knife. It's not so bad if you don't take yourself too seriously, but in that environment, there are many people who take themselves way over the top. Latin prayer, we sit down. Chaplains introduce me as having spoken in the evensong service, and a woman sitting across from me taught French, she taught history there. And she looks at me, and loudly, she says, "So, Jerry, why are you a Christian?" I thought she was maybe asking because she wanted to know, but people told me afterwards they thought she was asking because she wanted to make me the entertainment of that night's dinner, that she wanted to engage in a discussion and see if she couldn't make me look like a fool. My doctorate's in philosophy of religion. I might have been able to go toe-to-toe with her. I don't know. But I didn't become a Christian because of some slick argument. I didn't become a Christian because of somebody who was gifted in apologetics was able to convince me that I needed to get over the barriers that were intellectual to come to faith. And I looked at this woman, and with honesty, I said to her, "You know, I became a Christian because I was aware of brokenness in my life. I was aware of inconsistency, of things that were incongruent. I believed in love. I believed in the high ideal of love, but I kept finding myself falling short of my ideal and having sharp words, even with people I said I love most in the world. I believe in justice, but there have been times when I had been unfair in my treatment of others. I realized it after the fact, and I was so disappointed with myself." And I said, "I became a Christian because aware of those deficiencies, when I heard that God loved me unconditionally and that he forgave me of all those deficiencies, the things that the Bible calls sin, I found the message of his love and forgiveness compelling, and I responded to it." Well, she was taken back by that answer. It wasn't what she was expecting. She was expecting an argument and all that stuff. And she said, "Well, I can appreciate what you're saying, but it's just not my issue." I said, "Really? I think I understand what you're saying. I didn't become a Christian until I was in my first year of university. And I did not become perfect overnight. That took 2 or 3 weeks before that happened." And everybody at the table busted up in laughter when I said in 2 or 3 weeks, I had achieved perfection. They just laughed. And as soon as the laughter calmed down, I looked at this historian and I said, "Your laughter just betrayed you." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, you and I just met, so you don't know the details in my life that made that last statement utter nonsense. But either your read of history or your read of your own heart have told you nobody has it together. So in light of that, how do you get by?" She said to me when I said this to her, "You got me." I said, "I'm not interested in getting anybody. But when you know the realities of these things in your own life, what gets you by?" Now, here again, we awaken a person to deep felt need, and all of a sudden, the pathway is already paved for us to move from there to the gospel message in a way that it will be heard and responded to well. God is at work. I want to find out where he's working and make explicit what he's doing implicitly in those particular places. Now, What are the deep longings? What are they? And are there only these three? And I think no. In America, we had this horrible situation, this terrorist act on 9/11. We just call it 9/11 for short now. And it's when these airplanes were flown into the World Trade Center and into the Pentagon in America. And it was just tragic. 3,000 people were killed by these terrorist acts. It was particularly moving to me because there was this one flight, Flight 93, where there was a young man and some others on the flight. And this one young man was talking to somebody on the phone and said, okay, we're going to try and take over this plane from the terrorists. And then when it was time for them to act, he said, let's roll. Let's roll. His name was Todd Beamer. Todd Beamer used to come to my house for Bible study. He was a student at Wheaton College. I knew Todd. I knew his wife, Lisa. A couple of years ago, I did his premarital counseling for his son, Andrew. And here it was, a young man who got up in the morning to get on an airplane, to fly to another city, to do some business and fly back the next day. And the head he lifted from his pillow that morning never went back and rested on the pillow in his own home. And I remember thinking to myself, how can we be safe in this world? We all know people who started their day and got hit by a car, or they dropped dead, or they had an accident of some sort. And we say to ourselves, how can we be safe? Why do we expect safety when we live in a world where there's always been evidences of crises happening at particular moments? How can we be safe? I think that's a heaven longing, the one place where safety will ultimately exist. I remember saying on 9/11 too, what is this ultimately going to come to mean for us? And that's a question we're still asking. And I think the desire to want to make sense of our experience is a heaven longing. We can pick up on that and move to the gospel. Viktor Frankl, who suffered in the concentration camps in Nazi Germany, he was a psychiatrist. After the camps were over, he was trying to understand that experience. He wanted to make sense of it. And he wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And in that book, he said, if there's a meaning in life, then there must be a meaning in suffering. And when you meet a person who's trying to make sense of a conundrum, a difficult experience, that is an aid for you to begin to share the gospel about how the gospel itself can help us begin the process of making sense of our life's experience.